This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
We're going to look at one of the craziest pieces of the Chumash. I say that quite often, which must mean that most of the Torah is crazy, which is what's so delightful about it. I can't understand how boring people find anything in the Torah. It's such a mischievous book. And here we have the story of Avraham, who's an old man now, needing to find a wife for his son and heir, Yitzchak. This is probably one of the most important shidduchim ever made in the Torah. This is the first shidduch, in fact, that we have, the first match. The first couple that are getting married as Jews, Abraham and Sarah, were married long before that. And it's the foundation of the Jewish people. So although Sarah had established certain foundations, Rivka was going to be continuing the building of that process. So this is one of the most important shidduchim, if not the most important ever. What's the mechanism? How do you go about it? You call in your servant and you say, go and find a wife. And he goes overseas and goes to the stock exchange and says, the first pretty girl that comes past, and when I ask her for a glass of water, she says, I'll give you two, that'll be the girl. It's absolutely crazy. Who is she? Where does she come from? What's her background? What does she know? Why does he entrust her to Eliezer? And why is he using, why did he go to the well, and why is he using such an odd method for which he's criticized? The Gemara says there were four people who dealt with God incorrectly in this kind of situation. Three got away with it, one didn't. One was Eliezer. To do this kind of trickery, God, you're the first girl that comes and says this magic formula, and the first girl that comes, she'll be the right one. Life isn't simplistic like that. You're dealing with human issues, you're dealing with human beings, you're dealing with all sorts of dynamics. You can't simplify it down to a formula. The first girl that fits the criterion is the girl, and that's it. The second person who tried it and got away with it was Yehoshua, who said, anybody who conquers the city of Kiryat Sefer can marry my daughter. And he's got a very nice son-in-law. The third one was Shaul, who said, anybody who kills Goliath can marry my daughter, and he got a very nice son-in-law. And the fourth one was Yitzchak, who said, the first animal that comes out of, the first thing that comes out of my gate will be brought as a sacrifice, and his daughter walked out. That didn't work out too well for him. And there's discussion as to why, but there's an element of criticism of Eliezer. Yes, it works out exceedingly well. What is it about? And why does this be second matriarch of the Jewish nation gained that position by her position on cruelty to animals? I mean, she got it because she fed some camels. Had she given him, he asked for water, and she says, I'll give you, and I'll take care of your camels as well. So the camels is what flung it. Come on. Well, how would you feel if your son came home and said, this is the girl I want to marry? Why? Because she fed my puppy when I went there. I took my dog and I went to their house, and not only did she give me a cup of tea, but you know, she even gave my puppy something to eat. Gave my dog something to eat. This is the girl I'm marrying. If she can be like that to a dog, she can be like that to him. It doesn't mean anything. The Nazis were good to animals. What does it mean? What does kindness to animals mean? Kindness to animals usually means cruelty to people. People are usually kind to animals because they don't know how to engage with people, because they're not willing to engage with people. When there's an obsessive kindness to animals, and this was obsessive. What it's like to feed camels, to give camels that have been on a long journey through a desert. Somebody does a calculation of the quantity of water that each camel drinks and how much water this was altogether and how much she could contain in one of those pitchers that she was able to carry if she was a little girl. How many times she must have had to fill that pitcher in order to give the camels what to drink. It must have been a whole day's labor. It wasn't just a quick little thing. What did she do it for? Why did she do it? Why is it so critical? Why is it so important? If you go back to last week's year, we begin to understand where we're going. We said that Avraham was blessed with Bakol, and we gave two interpretations of Bakol, the Ramban and the Zohar. And the one view was that Bakul meant the Torah. And why is it called a daughter? Why does it say that he had a daughter and her name was Bakul? We said that means the Torah. That's how the Zohar learned it. And we said because the Torah was entrusted to Abraham to nurture as a daughter, that he was impacting on the development of the Torah. The Torah wasn't complete in a sense. The Torah went through a process of final molding, and that molding was done by man, not by God. The final product that we got at Sinai was the initial Torah as God had planned it, as God had given it, plus its nurturing. The genetic material, so to say, was all God. The daughter that a person has, the daughter's God, created, you're given. There's nothing you can do with the child. The material is what you're given. But you can mold the material. And so it was with the Torah. The material of the Torah was all from God, but Abraham molded it. Yaakov, these people molded the Torah into what it finally became. And the mold that they gave it was chesed. They introduced the humanism into the Torah. That the driving force of the Torah has to be chesed. That's what Abraham did. The driving force of the Torah has to be chesed. And what is chesed? There we came into the Ramban's view of Bakol as being the eighth of the 13 characteristics of God. And we analyzed that in the Talmud Dvorah, and we found that the eighth quality was the capacity to expand good to its maximum and contract bad evil to its minimum. Not to eliminate evil, but to contract it to its minimum and to expand good to its maximum. And that's the way God deals with us, and that's the way we're meant to deal with other people. And that was the middle, that was the characteristic of Bakol that differentiated Abraham from anybody else. And it was that that he infused into the Torah. And that, you'll remember, we tied into the eighth of the 13 principles of logic, of deductive logic. That being the case, what does Eliezer need to look for? Why Eliezer? Well, Eliezer was the most trusted student, disciple of Abraham. If Abraham couldn't do it himself, then Eliezer was certainly the second best. If Eliezer was good enough to choose a wife for Yitzhak, why was he not good enough to be Abraham, to provide Abraham with a son-in-law? Eliezer had a very fine son. And Eliezer couldn't understand a very fine daughter, and Eliezer couldn't understand why she was not fit for Yitzchak. Why go risking traveling overseas, finding somebody from some foreign culture, even if there's a family connection? But what kind of family? Look where she came from eventually, from Lavan. So all very well saying that Rivka came from Abraham's family, but she came from Lavan's family also. Lavan was a cheat, he was an idol worshipper. It wasn't a very nice family that she came from. Why go and take this girl from a bad family, good genes but bad environment, and you don't know her, bring her over here? Well, you've got in your home somebody that's grown up in your home. Eliezer's daughter has grown up in the home of Abraham. Eliezer and his wife grown up in the home of Abraham, the most trusted people, the greatest scholars of that time. And the Gemara deals with that and says, because Eliezer is descended from Canaan, as were all the people in that environment, in that nation. And Canaan is Arur. Arur means cursed. The Ein Arur mitzabek v'boruch. Curse and blessing don't connect. The dynamic doesn't work. No matter how nice the people are, no matter how much they love each other, it doesn't work. Are Eliezer's children Jewish? What would you say? Absolutely, yes. Are they Talmidei Chachomim? Absolutely. So if Mrs. Eliezer walked into the shir, what do you think she would look like in today's terminology? Right out of Meir Shorim. She wouldn't have looked any less from than that. She would have come right out of Meir Shorim. Probably isn't the frumest place anymore. Meir Shorim used to be the frumest place. Now it's probably Mattersdorf. Meir Shorim is now probably the old-fashioned frum, but the real modern, serious room. I mean, you're looking at Mattersdorf and these real places, you know, these serious places, the new places. And imagine Mrs. Eliezer coming in. Imagine her daughter coming in. What school do you think her daughter went to? Of course, probably not Beit Yaakov. It's Fatima. This is the extreme of the. There wasn't anybody more religious than these people. And imagine her being proposed as a shidduch, and the shatran saying to Avraham, "This girl, look at her, modest, wonderful family. Her father's the second biggest Talmid Chacham in the world, third biggest. Avraham's the greatest, Yitzchak's the second, Eliezer must be the third. Father's the third greatest Talmid Chacham in the world." They've grown up in a home, this girl has grown up in a home none other than the home of Avraham. None other than the home of Avraham. You can't imagine. We didn't get the message to you. We were starting a little earlier today.
Thank you. You did.
I did.
You did.
Well, that's wonderful. The communication system worked. That's all right.
Thank you.
Oh, right. Of course, you were there. You were there on Monday night. Yeah.
Thank you.
So here's this wonderful girl, wonderful family, wonderful leaders, wonderful everything. And Avraham says, "No, thank you." So who's going to marry Yitzchak? There's this girl from Lavan. Lavan. He's not even Jewish. True. Not Jewish. He's a cheat in business. True. He's an idol worshiper. True. His daughter. That's who I was talking about. That's who I want. Why? Because you see, Mrs. or Miss Eliezer, you descended from Canaan. And that's a flaw that is not going to marry into my genetic pool. Because that will never get undone. It won't sit. It won't work. Your value system, your religious value system is the same as my son's. Your spiritual system is the same as my son's. Your background is, in every way you're the same. There's only one area in which you're incompatible. And that's the area of Arur and Baruch. What does Arur mean? What does Baruch mean? The Maharal Mipraz defines brocha as more than you need. If God gives you what you need, that's not brocha. Brocha is more than you need. When God gives you things you don't need, that's brocha. So then what is arur? What is klal? What is curse? If that's blessing, what is curse? When you don't even have what you need. If you have what you need, you're neither blessed nor cursed. If you have more than you need, you're blessed. If you have less than you need, you're cursed, in a sense. But what's important in the Baruch and the Oru is not so much what you are, but how you are. What is a Brocha Dika person? How does he look at the world? He wants people to have more than they need. He rejoices when people have more than they need. He loves people having more than they need. And an Oru Dika person? Why is that person got that? What does he need in him? What does he need in his life? That's the cursed kind of person. Have you ever heard even religious people saying that? What do they need 3 cars for? What do they need a tennis court for? Have you ever heard that kind of thing? Do they really need it? That's Oru. That's descendants of Canaan. What do they need it for? They don't need it. And you can dress it up religiously, you can dress it, it can be financial, it can be religious, it can be social. It's a meanness of spirit that takes no pleasure in people having more than they need. You know what? He doesn't need a tennis court. And that yacht doesn't need that either. And his 6 cars, he doesn't need them either. And his apartment in Paris, and that one in London, and the one in Jerusalem, he never uses them. They're locked up. And isn't it wonderful that God's being so good to him? That's the approach. That's Baruch. And Avraham says, "I'm not having Oru marrying into our family. I don't care how religious you are. I don't care where you come from. You're descendants of Canaan. And so is everybody in this place. And although I've taught them, and I've educated them, the one thing I haven't got out of it was that meanness. And therefore my daughter-in-law has to come from another nation. Because everything else I can teach her. The one thing I see I can't teach somebody is to be Baruch when they are inherently Oru." So he takes Eliezer, of all people, who himself is from that background, and gets him to understand why he and his family can't qualify. And he says, "Now what I want, Eliezer, is somebody just like you, just like your family, that Baruch. Go and find one. That's what I need." So what does Eliezer do? He says, "Genetic pool then, there's only one that's good enough, and that's Abraham's own family. So I better go to where his family is." But I've got to find within that genetic group a girl who has this one quality. The quality of bako, of wanting everything, of loving it, just of excess. A girl who delights in more than is needed. And how does he test? He says to God, he goes to the well. He wants to watch this girl interact where there is no family pressure or expectation, where she's dealing with an anonymous person, being watched by her peers, not her family. And her peers don't share that value system. So it's not a cool thing for a young girl to go feeding camels. That's not the thing to be doing. So he puts her in a position where her own value system is in fact being challenged by her environment, where her parents are not there to influence her decision as to how she acts at all. She's on her own. And he tests her in a commercial environment. He tests her out in the marketplace. See how a girl acts at home, that's easy. What's at home? The parents say, you're surrounded by people you love. When you're surrounded by people you love, it's nice, it's easy to have tested. The thing is, when you're surrounded by people you don't like, how do you treat your competitors? Then we'll see what kind of pressure there is. How do you treat the people that work for you? How do you treat strangers that you don't know at all, that you owe nothing to, and that you will know nothing to? So what do they say today? The Shadchanim says, see a girl in her home, and then you'll know what kind of a wife she'll be. Says Eliezer, no. See a girl in her home, and you've got no clue what wife she'll be. See a girl outside of her home. See a girl in the marketplace. See a girl where her parents aren't. See a girl where her siblings aren't. Just see her out where she's on her own. And she's faced with a dilemma, or she's faced with an opportunity, with a challenge. And he said to God, Hakreino lefanai hayom, appear before me today. Make a happening happen. Va'asei chesed im Adoni Avraham, and do kindness to my master Avraham. And we need to note, he doesn't say, and do nisim, do miracles with my master Avraham. I'm not looking for a miracle. Just be kind. In Anochi nitzav alein hamayim, I'm going to stand by the well. And the young girls from the city, from the town, will be coming out to draw water. So I only want those girls who go out to draw water. The girls who are helping, who are contributing to the home. I don't want the kugel who's sitting at home. I want the girls who are contributing. So I'm not even looking in the kugel pie. I'm looking. They have kugels in America. They don't have kugels. They don't have kugels.
Yeah.
I don't have faribles, I don't have kugels.
Kugel is a jack.
A jack, yeah, right. A kugel. But a kugel is more than a jack. I mean, a kugel is a kugel, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, it's an American princess. South African version
of kugel. Yeah. So, you think noodles? No. A kugel is a... Oh, one day we'll describe to you exactly what a kugel is. But I suppose that you get an idea. Those are not what she wants. What he wants. He doesn't even want the girls who are absent. He wants a girl who's contributing. A girl who says, if I'm staying at home, I want to be contributing to home. What can I be doing to help? And she does what she saves others from doing. So she goes out to the well, as a lot of girls do. And the girl to whom I will say, Hatino Chadech Veshtet. He's not going to go up to every girl and say that. He says, I will choose a girl. So I'm going to look around, and if I see a pretty girl, a nice looking girl, a girl that seems to have pain, I'll try it with her. The girl to whom I say, tilt your pitcher and let me drink. The Omro, and she will say, Shasei Vegam Gemolecho Ashke. Drink, and I will feed your camel too. So he saw the Chachzol Avrochol Yitzchak. That's the girl that you have identified for Yitzchak. Edo, and through her I shall know that you've indeed done kindness with my master. What is the quality he's looking for? Is that expanding the good? If he would just say chesed, a girl that notices that I need something to drink, if he would just say when I ask a girl for a drink, if she does it willingly. But that's not what he's looking for. He's looking for somebody who expands goodness. Now, we talked about expanding goodness last week in terms of where you see a situation and you're making a judgment. So try and see the good in its most expanded form. and try and see the bad in its most contracted form, so that the picture that you get is a bright picture not a dark picture. But there's another element to the expansion of good, and that is the expansion of the opportunities to do good. That's also a different thing. Sometimes an opportunity to do good exists and you don't notice it, because you don't want to notice it, because it requires investment to do good. So we narrow our perspective of the opportunities to contribute. We don't see them. We don't notice that here's an opportunity. What he's looking for is somebody who notices every opportunity to do good. And one of the differences between chesed and tzedakah, we've discussed some of the differences before, but one of the differences between chesed and tzedakah, or chesed and rachamim, kindness and mercy, kindness and charity, is that mercy is a response to the other person's need. Chesed is a need of the giver. I need to be doing chesed. Let me find opportunities. Rachamim is, oh my goodness, you're thirsty, I'll get you something to drink. You need some money, I'll give you some money. Chesed is, who can I find to give some money to? Where would I be making the best contribution? I've got some money that I can give away, that I can give a charity. Where can I find somebody deserving? And how can I make a little more money, so that the money that I can give to charity is not only $100,000, but it's $200,000. Where can I find an opportunity to make a little bit more profit so that I can give more charity, and where can I find that opportunity? It's a different way of looking at the world. The one seeks opportunities to contribute, and the other responds to needs at best. Completely different perspective. And it's a different perspective in social relations, it's a different perspective in parenting, it's a different perspective in relationships, it's a different perspective in business. When one is driven by the need to contribute, by the need to give, rather than responding to a need. When you respond to a need, what are you driven by? What is the emotion that drives you? Sorry? What?
Guilt.
It's actually responding to guilt. Somebody needs, maybe I'll be in that position one day. Doesn't feel comfortable. Get rid of the feeling. Pay the feeling off. That's all it is. That's not chesed. Chesed is understanding that my esteem, my value, is a function of how much I contribute. People always talk, self-esteem. I need self-esteem. I need respect. I need to contribute. That's the only cause for self-esteem, but you can't get it any other way. Make yourself valuable. You can't be made valuable by other people. If you're making a valuable contribution, then you will be valued. If you are not making a valuable contribution, you will not be valued. There are many ways to make valuable contributions. But the person who's driven by his desire to find self-value through the contribution he makes is the bakul person. That's the person whose eyes are wide open, looking for opportunities to make a contribution, looking for opportunities to create, looking for opportunities to make impact, looking for opportunities to enrich people's lives. Those are the great visionaries of the world. Those are the great entrepreneurs of the world. Those are the great academicians of the world. Those are the great rabbonim of the world. Those are the great people of the world. In every area of life, even in their own area, those are the great areas. When we talk about smallness and bigness, it doesn't matter what your base is. The Prophet Chaim lived in one little room in total poverty, but his vision was the world. The world, he took in the world, he related to the world, he engaged in the world, contributed to the world. That's the vision. You can have a person who lives on a 50-acre estate, and his vision is maybe 50 acres, if he's lucky. That's small. And a person lives in one room, and his vision is global. It's not a question of how big your life is, it's a question of how big your vision is in terms of scanning for opportunities to make a contribution. When this girl comes and she sees Eliezer tired, thirsty, and he says, can you give me a little water? What does that do to her? Not, oh my goodness, that means I'm going to be late. That means also, why me of all people? Why did he pick on me? There's so many pretty girls here. Why me? No. My goodness, this is an opportunity. Not only him, but this is an opportunity for the camels as well. Is she doing kindness to animals? No, that's not her issue. Her issue is, if I don't feed her his camels, who has to feed his camels? He will. He's just told me he's too thirsty to lift up a pitcher. This man is tired, he's thirsty. His need is far more than the water for which he's asked. Imagine if she were in the business of providing water. You see what she's just done with her market? You see how she's just expanded her market by noticing something that her competitors would never have noticed. Her competitors would have said, you know, there's some old people who come this way, and when they come, they're thirsty. Let's provide water for them. So how much water would you sell? But she's identified a much bigger opportunity. If he's too thirsty and tired to lift a pitcher to feed himself, how is he going to feed the animal? Bigger opportunity for chesed. Bigger opportunity for kindness. Greater investment in people. What has this got to do with Torah? Nothing. Is this for Jewish people only? No. This has nothing to do with Torah. The Gemara says that the Derech Eretz, however one wishes to translate that, preceded the Torah by 26 generations. Some say preceded the world by 26 generations. But the Derech Eretz was in place long before that, and these people kept the whole Torah without having been given it. The Torah didn't have to be given. It had to be given to make it to legislate it. It had to be given to make it apply to everybody. But human beings had the capacity to work it all out. You don't have to be religious to know this kind of stuff. And you can be religious and not know this kind of stuff. This is a precondition for Torah. This is not even Torah. Torah, Abraham says, I'll teach you. Yitzchak will teach you. That's not the problem. But an attitude, a bigness of spirit, somebody who seeks opportunities for kindness rather than who seeks opportunities to escape from kindness, that you can't teach a person. That they've either got it or they don't know. We don't want to get involved in teaching that. That's not what we're teaching. That should be the material with which we're working. Those should be the people that we're teaching. Those are the people who sit to be learning Torah. When you teach Torah to a mean-spirited person, what happens? What happens to the person? They become more mean-spirited. It's all that happens. It doesn't open them. Torah itself is not an opening experience. Would you say Torah is a narrowing or a widening experience? By its nature, if anything, it's narrowing. Can't do this, can't do this, can't do this. If anything, it's narrowing. Take a narrow person and focus him, he becomes narrower. Take a broad person and focus him, he becomes a laser beam. He becomes powerful. Completely different thing. He doesn't sacrifice that breath, gets focused. Take a narrow person and focus them, they're even narrow. It doesn't add anything, it doesn't give anything. Torah doesn't widen. Torah doesn't open up. That all has to be there before you start. Take a Rivka and teach her Torah, and now you've got a matriarch. Now you've got somebody who can change the world. But if she isn't that way to start, it doesn't help putting her through the Beis Yaakov system. She's not going to come out a matriarch, she'll come out a Shlemiel. And Abraham realizes that. Find the quality, find the person. Don't be distracted by the externals. Find the person who has the quality. And there's one quality I'm looking for. Bakol. What does Bakol mean?
Everything.
It's everything. If she's got this, she's got it all. And if she hasn't got this, she's got nothing. Everything else we can teach her. This she must have. And Eliezer devises the test for that one leader. He's got to find somebody who has that quality. Now this concept of generosity and meanness, by the way, is a quality that applies not only in the physical and material world, it applies in the spiritual world as well. There is one becomes mean, and this is how the human side ties up to the godly side of the Torah. One becomes mean when one believes in limitation. If you believe that there's only a certain amount of money around, and if you don't get it, somebody else does, or if somebody else gets it, you don't, that's when you become mean. When you believe that money is the outcome of the human capacity to create, then you realize that your money comes from your capacity to create, and that's what you need to focus on your giving, not on your taking. And so when one has a secular approach, a quantitative approach to the generation of wealth, there is meanness. When one has a spiritual approach to the generation of wealth, there is bigness. Exactly the same thing happens in Torah. And it's something we'll be talking about at the community meeting on Saturday night this week. It happens in communities the same. There can be a meanness of spirit that permeates subconsciously without people even noticing it. And what is the meanness of spirit? We want it all for ourselves. Let's keep it for ourselves. If there'll be 50 people in the shul instead of 20, it's not intimate anymore. So let's keep it at 20 people. Let's not tell anybody about it. Because then it's out of the shul. You feel nice. There's a meanness. Keep it to ourselves. And let's get out of that. As to turn Torah into something quantitative, not only if you see the spirituality as, if you see money as spiritual, not only is it not limited, but in fact the more people you have involved in it, the more wealth is generated, not the less. But it doesn't normally happen that way. Mostly it happens depending on how they compete. If they're not destructive in their competition, they actually grow the total business beyond what it was before. How does that work? It doesn't make economic sense, it makes spiritual sense. People are generating. The more people that are generating, the more this cross-generation, all sorts of opportunities happen. So it goes. So it is with Torah. If you've got 50 people learning Torah, the Torah is richer. If you've got 100 people learning Torah, the Torah is richer. You don't become impoverished, you become richer. But there is a tendency in communities and in yeshivas and in all sorts of Torah situations too, to hang on to something small because there's comfort in that intimacy. And it's not always wise, not always. There are times, there is a place for it, there are times for it. But there are times when that's suicidal. And one needs to caution oneself, one needs to be very aware of when that starts to happen. There is a certain comfort in a shtetlism. And it's when it's not appropriate. Shtetl is fine when you know that the shtetl, how many people were there in the shtetls of old? How big were the shtetls? Hundreds of families. In the small shtetls, there were hundreds of families. In the big shtetls, there were tens of thousands of families. Then you can have a shtetl. 20 families is not a shtetl. 50 families is not a shtetl. 100 families is not even a shtetl. 100 families is pathetic. 500 families is a shtetl. Now you can start talking about a shtetl, but when you've got 50 people talking about a shtetl, that's pathetic. What they're really saying is, keep up. They're not saying it's not even a shtetl. It's too incestuous, too small. There needs to be a sense, one needs to have a sense of expansiveness in everything that one does. Abraham goes around to change the world, to expand, and he's looking for expansionism. That's the one quality that is the essence of brocha. And people wonder why they don't have brocha in their lives, and there can be many reasons for it. But believe me, the biggest reason for not having brocha in one's life is because one's just not a brocha bigger person. As simple as that. We determine, mostly, whether we have brocha in our lives or not. Depends how we choose to look at the world. We choose to look at the world through eyes of brocha, God responds with brocha. Not always, but often. If we choose to look at the world through eyes of plola, of cursedness, of narrowness, of smallness, then God responds with narrowness and smallness. Not always, but often. The way we choose to look at the world, the way we choose to look at opportunity, the way we choose to look at kindness, determines how we interact with the whole world and how God interacts with us. We make the rules. God plays the game with us. And we have the capacity to make the rules. And the one thing Avraham lays down is an absolute non-negotiable criteria. Everything else is negotiable. They can come from idol worshippers. Doesn't matter. So I also came from idol worship. You can change an idol worshipper into a God believer. But you can't change a mean person into a blessed person. Mean person, they can be Jewish, they can be Jerry Yeshiva, they can become Talmidei Chachomim, but they're not going to become contributors. And so Eliezer goes off on his mission, applies his test, and identifies Rivka as the future wife for Yitzchak.